Side 3. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 49. He had picked up Trisquelyne with incredible ease. She had little doubt that he was the master skipper he claimed, and to be a traitor in the slowness, to risk centuries between the stars for a destination that might have fallen from civilization or become deadly hostile to outsiders, that took courage that was hard to imagine. She could understand how he might think going to the Transcend was just another challenge. He'd had about 20 days to absorb a whole new universe. That simply wasn't enough time to understand that the rules change when the players are more than human. Well, he still had a few days of grace. She would change his mind, and after talking to Gronder just now, she wouldn't feel especially guilty about doing it. Chapter 8. The foreign quarter was actually about a third of the docks. It abutted the no-atmosphere periphery, where ships actually docked, and extended inwards to a section of the central sea. Vrini Meorg had convinced a significant number of races that this was a wonder of the middle beyond. In addition to freight traffic, there were tourists, some of the wealthiest beings in the beyond. Von Neuen had carte blanche to these amusements. Ropna took him through the more spectacular ones, including an agrav hop over the docks. The barbarian was more impressed by their pocket spacesuits than by the docks.
I've seen structures bigger than that down in the slowness.
Not hovering in a planetary gravity well, you haven't. Von Neuen seemed to mellow as the evening progressed. At least his comments became more perceptive, less edged. He wanted to see how real traders lived in the beyond, and Ravna showed him the bourses and the traders' local. They ended up in the wandering company just after Doc's midnight. This was not organization territory, but it was one of Ravna's favorite places, a private dive that attracted traders from the top to the bottom. She wondered how the decor would appeal to Von Neuen. The place was modeled as a meeting lodge on some world of the slow zone. A 3-meter model ram scoop hung in the air over the main service floor. Blue-green dry fields glowed from the ship's every corner and flange and spread faintly among patrons sitting below. To Ravna, the walls and floors were heavy timber, rough-cut. People like Egravan saw stone walls and narrow tunnels, the sort of brutery his race had maintained on new conquests of long ago. The trickery was optical, not some metal smudging, and about the best that could be done in the middle beyond. Ravna and Fom walked between widely spaced tables. The owners weren't as successful with sound as with vision. The music was faint and changed from table to table. Smells changed, too, and were a little bit harder to take. Air management was working hard to keep everyone healthy, if not completely comfortable. Tonight the place was crowded. At the far end of the service floor, the special atmosphere nooks were occupied. Low-pressure, high-pressure, high-NO subscript X Aquaria. Some customers were vague blurs within turbid atmospheres. In some ways, it might have been a port bar at Chandra K. Yet, this was Relay. It attracted high beyonders who would never come to backwaters like Chandra K. Most of the high ones didn't look very strange. Civilizations at the top were most often just colonies from below. But the headbands she saw here were not jewelry. Mind computer links aren't efficient in the middle beyond, but most of the high beyonders would not give them up. Ravna started toward a group of banded tripods and their machines. Let Von Neuen talk with creatures who teetered on the edge of transsapience. Surprisingly, he touched her arm, drawing her back.
Let's walk around a little more.
He was looking all around the hall as if searching for a familiar face.
Let's find some other humans first.
When holes showed in Von Neuen's cram education, they were gapingly wide. Ravna tried to keep her face serious.
Other humans? We're all there is at Relay Farm.
But the friends you've been telling me about. Egravan, Sarale.
Ravna just shook her head. For a moment, the barbarian looked vulnerable. Fom Nguyen had spent his life crawling at sublight between human-colonized star systems. She knew that in all that life he had seen only three non-human races. Now he was lost in a sea of alienness. She kept her sympathy to herself. This one insight might affect the guy more than all her arguing. But the instant passed, and he was smiling again.
Even more an adventure.
They left the main floor and walked past special atmosphere nooks.
Lord, but Cheng Ho would love this.
No humans anywhere, and the wandering company was the homiest meeting place she knew. Many org customers met only on the net. She felt her own homesickness welling up. On the second floor, a signet flag caught her eye. She'd known something like it back at Chandra K. She drew Fom Nguyen across the floor and started up the timbered stairs. Out of the background murmur, she heard a high-pitched twittering. It wasn't Trisk Weilang, but the words made sense. By the powers, it was Somnorsh.
I do believe it's a homo sap. Over here, my lady.
She followed the sound to the table with the signet flag.
May we sit with you?
She asked, savoring the familiar language.
Please do.
The twitterer looked like a small ornamental tree sitting in a six-wheeled cart. The cart was marked with cosmetic stripes and tassels. Its 150 by 120 centimeter topside was covered with a cargo scarf in the same pattern as the signet flag. The creature was a greater scrota rider. Its race traded through much of the middle beyond, including Chandra K. The scrota rider's high-pitched voice came from its voder.
But speaking Somnorsh, it sounded homier than anything she'd heard in a long time. Even granting the mental peculiarities of scrota riders, she felt a surge of affectionate nostalgia, as if she had run into an old classmate in a far city.
My name is...
The sound was the rustling of fronds.
But you can easier call me Blue Shell. It's nice to see a familiar face, ha ha ha.
Blue Shell spoke the laughter as words.
Fom Nguyen had sat down with Ravna, but he understood not a word of Somnorsh, and so the great reunion was lost on him.
The rider switched to Trisk Weilang and introduced his four companions, another scrota rider and three humanoids who seemed to like the shadows. None of the humanoids spoke Somnorsh, but no one was more than one translator hop from Trisk Weilang. The scrota riders were owners-operators of a small interstellar freighter, the Out of Band 2. The humanoids were certificates for part of the starship's current cargo.
My mate and I have been in the business almost 200 years. We have happy feelings for your race, my lady. Our first runs were between Chandra K and Forsta Utgrep. Your people are good customers, and we scarcely ever have a shipment rot.
He wheeled his scrota back from the table and then drove forward, the equivalent of a small bow. All was not sweetness and light, however. One of the humanoids spoke. The sounds could almost have come from a human throat, though they made no sense. A moment passed as the house translator processed his words. Then the brooch on his jacket spoke in clear Trisk Weilang. Blue Shell states you are Homo sapiens. Know that you have our animosity. We are bankrupt, near stranded here, by your race's evil creation, the Straumli perversion. The words sounded emotionless, but Ravna could see the creature's tense posture, its fingers twisting at a drink bulb. Considering his attitude, it probably wouldn't help to point out that though she was human, Chandra K was thousands of light years from Straum.
You came here from the realm? She asked the scrota rider.
Blue Shell didn't answer immediately. That's the way it was with his race. He was probably trying to remember who she was and what they were all talking about. Then,
yes, yes, please do excuse my certificate's hostility. Our main cargo is a one-time cryptographic pad. The source is commercial security at Chandra K. The destination is the certificate's high colony. It was the usual arrangement. We're carrying a one-third Zor off the pad. Independent shippers are carrying the others. At the destination, the three parts would be Zored together.
The result could supply a dozen worlds' crypto needs on the net for... Downstairs, there was a commotion. Someone was smoking something a bit too strong for the air scrubbers. Ravna caught a whiff, enough to shimmer her vision. It had knocked out several patrons on the main level. Management was counseling the offending customer. Blueshell made an abrupt noise. He backed his scrota from the table and rolled to the railing. "Don't want to be caught unawares. Some people can be so abrupt." When nothing more came of the incident, he returned. Where was I?" He was silent a moment, consulting the short-term memory built into his scrota. "Yes, yes. We would become relatively rich if our plans work out. Unfortunately, we stopped on Strong to drop off some bulk data." He pivoted on his rear four wheels. "Surely that was safe. Strom itself is more than 100 light-years from their lab in the Transcend, yet..." One of the certificates interrupted with loud gabble. The house translator kicked in a moment later. "Yes, it should have been safe. We saw no violence. Ship's recorders show that our safeness was not breached. Yet now there are rumors. Net groups claim that Stromley Realm is owned by perversion. Absurdity. Yet these rumors have crossed the net to our destination. Our cargo was not trusted, so our cargo was ruined. Now it is only a few grams of data medium carrying random..." In the middle of the flat-voiced translation, the humanoid lunged out of the shadows. Ravna had a glimpse of a jaw edged with razor-sharp gums. He threw his drink bulb at the table in front of her. Fom Nguyen's hand flashed out, snatching the drink before it hit, before she had quite realized what was happening. The redhead came slowly to his feet. From the shadows, the two other humanoids came to their feet and moved toward their friend. Fom Nguyen didn't say a word. He set the bulb carefully down and leaned just slightly toward the other, his hands relaxed yet blade-like. Cheap fiction talks about looks of deadly menace. Ravna had never expected to see the real thing, but the humanoids saw it too. They tugged their friend gently back from the table. The loudmouth did not resist, but once beyond Fom's reach, he erupted in a barrage of squeals and hisses that left the house translator speechless. He made a sharp gesture with three fingers and shut up. The three swept silently down the stairs and away. Fom Nguyen sat down, his gray eyes calm and untroubled. Maybe he did have something to be arrogant about. Ravna looked across at the two scrota riders. "I'm sorry your cargo lost value." Most of Ravna's past contacts had been with lesser scrota riders whose reflexes were only slightly augmented beyond their sessile heritage. Had these two even noticed the interruption? But Blueshell answered immediately. "Do not apologize. Ever since our arrival, those three have been complaining. Contract partners or not, I'm very tired of them." He lapsed into potted plant mode. After a moment, the other rider, Greenstalk was it, spoke. "Besides, our commercial situation may not be a complete failure. Now, I am sure the other thirds of the shipment went nowhere near Stromley Realm." That was the usual procedure anyway. Each part of the shipment was carried by a different company, each taking a very different path. If the other thirds could be certified, the crew of the out-of-band might not come away empty-handed. In fact, there may be a way we can get full certification. True, we were at Stromley, Maine, but..."
"How long ago did you leave?"
650 hours ago. About 200 hours after they dropped off the net." It suddenly dawned on Ravna that she was talking to something like eyewitnesses. After 30 days, the threat's news was still dominated by the events at Strom. The consensus was that a Class II perversion had been created. Even Vreeni Meorg believed that. Yet it was still mainly guesswork. And here she was talking to beings who had actually been there.
"You don't think the Stromers created a perversion?"
It was Blueshell who replied.
"Sigh," he said. "Our certificates deny it, but I see a problem of conscience here. We did witness strangeness on Strom. Have you ever encountered artificial immune systems? The ones that work in the middle beyond are more trouble than they're worth, so perhaps not. I noticed a real change in certain officers of the Crypto Authority right after the Stromley victory. It was as if they were suddenly part of a poorly calibrated automation, as if they were somebody's, fingers. No one can doubt they were playing in the Transcend. They found something up there, a lost archive, but that is not the point. He stopped talking for a long moment. Ravna almost thought he was finished. You see, just before leaving Stromley, Maine, we... But now Fom Nguyen was talking, too.
That's something I've been wondering about. Everybody talks as though this Stromley realm was doomed the moment they began research in the Transcend. Look, I've played with bugged software and strange weapons. I know you can get killed that way. But it looks like the Stromers were careful to put their lab far away. They were building something that could go very wrong, but apparently it was a previously tried experiment, like just about everything up here. They could stop the work any time it deviated from the records right up to the end. So how could they screw up so bad?
The question stopped the Schroederwriter in its tracks. He didn't need a doctorate in applied theology to know the answer. Even the damn Stromers should have known the answer. But given Fom Nguyen's background, it was a reasonable question. Ravna kept her mouth shut. The Schroederwriter's very alienness might be more convincing to Fom than another lecture from her. Blueshell dithered for a moment, no doubt using his scrota to help assemble his arguments. When he finally spoke, he didn't seem irritated by the interruption. I hear several misconceptions, my lady Fom. He seemed to use the old New Yoran honorific pretty indiscriminately. Have you been into the archive at Relay? Fom said yes. Ravna guessed he'd never been past the beginner's front end. Then you know that an archive is a fundamentally vaster thing than the database on a conventional local net. For practical purposes, the big ones can't even be duplicated. The major archives go back millions of years, have been maintained by hundreds of different races, most now extinct or transcended into powers. Even the archive at Relay is a jumble, so huge that indexing systems are laid on top of indexing systems. Only in the Transcend could such a mass be well organized, and even then only the powers could understand it. So, there are thousands of archives in the Beyond, tens of thousands if you count the ones that have fallen into disrepair or dropped off the net, along with unending trivia. They contain important secrets and important lies. There are traps and snares. Millions of races played with the advice that filtered unsolicited across the net. Tens of thousands had been burned thereby. Sometimes the damage was relatively minor, good inventions that weren't quite right for the target environment. Sometimes it was malicious, viruses that would jam a local net so thoroughly that a civilization must restart from scratch. Where are they now? And threats carried stories of worse tragedies. Planets knee-deep in replicant goo, races turned brainless by badly programmed immune systems. Fom Nguyen was wearing his skeptical expression.
Just test the stuff at a safe remove. Be prepared for local disasters.
That would have brought most explanations to a stop. Ravna had to admire the Schroederwriter. He paused, retreated to still more elementary terms. True, simple caution can prevent many disasters, and if your lab is in the middle or low beyond, such caution is all that is really needed, no matter how sophisticated the threat. But we all understand the nature of the zones. Ravna had virtually no feel for rider body language, but she would have sworn that Blueshell was watching the barbarian expectantly, trying to gauge the depth of Fom's ignorance. The human nodded impatiently. Blueshell continued. In the Transcend, truly sophisticated equipment can operate devices substantially smarter than anyone down here. Of course, almost any economic or military competition can be won by the side with superior computing resources. Such can be had at the top of the Beyond and in the Transcend. Races are always migrating there, hoping to build their utopias. But what do you do when your new creations may be smarter than you are?
It happens that there are limitless possibilities for disaster, even if an existing power does not cause harm. So there are unnumbered recipes for safely taking advantage of the transcend. Of course, they can't be effectively examined except in the transcend. And run on devices of their own description, the recipes themselves become sentient. Understanding was beginning to glimmer across Fom Nguyen's face. Ravna leaned forward, caught the redhead's attention.
There are complex things in the archives. None of them is sentient, but some have the potential if some naive young race will only believe their promises. We think that's what happened to Straumli Realm. They were tricked by documentation that claimed miracles, tricked into building a transcendent being, a power, but one that victimizes Sophants in the beyond.
She didn't mention how rare such perversion was. The powers were variously malevolent, playful, indifferent. But virtually all of them had better uses for their time than exterminating cockroaches in the wild. Fom Nguyen rubbed his jaw thoughtfully.
Okay, I guess I see. But I get the feeling this is common knowledge. If it's this deadly, how did the Straumli bunch get taken in?
Bad luck and criminal incompetence. The words popped out of her with surprising force. She hadn't realized she was so bent by the Straumli thing. Somewhere inside, her old feelings for Straumli Realm were still alive. Look, operations in the High Beyond and in the Transcend are dangerous. Civilizations up there don't last long, but there will always be people who try. Very few of the threats are actively evil. What happened to the Straumers? They ran across this recipe advertising wondrous treasure. Quite possibly it had been lying around for millions of years, a little too risky for other folks to try. You're right, the Straumers knew the dangers. But it was a classic situation of balancing risks and choosing wrong. Perhaps a third of applied theology was about how to dance near the flame without getting incinerated. No one knew the details of the Straumli debacle, but she could guess them from 100 similar cases. So they set up a base in the Transcend at this lost archive, if that's what it was. They began implementing the schemes they found. You can be sure they spent most of their time watching it for signs of deception. No doubt the recipe was a series of more or less intelligible steps with a clear takeoff point. The early stages would involve computers and programs more effective than anything in the beyond, but apparently well-behaved.
Yeah, even in the slowness, a big program can be full of surprises.
Ravna nodded. And some of these would be near or beyond human complexity. Of course, the Straumers would know this and try to isolate their creations. But given a malignant and clever design, it should be no surprise if the devices leaked onto the lab's local net and distorted the information there. From then on, the Straumers wouldn't have a chance. The most cautious staffers would be framed as incompetent. Phantom threats would be detected, emergency responses demanded. More sophisticated devices would be built and with fewer safeguards. Conceivably, the humans were killed or rewritten before the perversion even achieved transapience. There was a long silence. Fom Nguyen looked almost chastened. Yeah, there's a lot you don't know, buddy. Think on what Old One might have planned for you. Blueshell bent a tendril to taste a brown concoction that smelled like seaweed.
Well told, my Lady Ravna. But there is one difference in the present situation. It may be good fortune and very important. You see, just before leaving Straumli, Maine, we attended a beach party among the lesser riders.
They had been little affected by events to that point. Many hadn't even noticed the destruction of independence at Straum.
With luck, they may be the last enslaved. His squeaky voice lowered an octave, trailing into silence. Where was I? Yes, the party. There was one fellow there, a bit more lively than the average. Somewhere years past, he had bonded with a traveler in a Stroumly news service. Now he was acting as a clandestine data drop, so humble that he wasn't even listed in that service's own net. Anyway, the researchers at the Stroumly lab, a few of them at least, were not so incautious as you say. They suspected a perverse runaway and were determined to sabotage it. This was news, but doesn't look like they had much success, does it? I am nodding agreement. They did not prevent it, but they did plan to escape the laboratory planet with two starships. And they did get word of their attempt into channels that ended with my acquaintance at the beach party. And here is the important part. At least one of these ships was to carry away some final elements of the perversion's recipe before they were incorporated into the design.
Surely there were backups, began von Neuwen.
Rothner waved him silent. There had been enough grade school explanations for one night. This was incredible. She'd been following the news about Stroumly Realm as much as anyone. The realm was the first High Daughter colony of Chandra K. It was horrifying to see it destroyed, but nowhere in threats had there been even a rumor of this. The perversion not whole?
If this is true, then the Stroumers may have a chance. It all depends on the missing parts of the design document.
Just so. And of course the humans realized this too. They planned to head straight for the bottom of the beyond, rendezvous there with their accomplices from Stroum. Which, considering the ultimate magnitude of the disaster, would never happen. Ravna leaned back, oblivious of von Neuwen, for the first time in many hours. Most likely both ships had been destroyed by now. If not, well, the Stroumers had been at least half smart, heading for the bottom. If they had what Blueshell thought, the perversion would be very interested in finding them. It was no wonder Blueshell and Greenstalk hadn't announced this on the news groups.
So you know where they were going to rendezvous? She said softly.
Approximately. Greenstalk birred something at him. Not in ourselves, he said. The coordinates are in the safeness at our ship. But there is more. The Stroumers had a backup plan if the rendezvous failed. They intended to signal relay with their ship's ultrawave.
Now wait, just how big is this ship?
Ravna was no physical layer engineer, but she knew that relay's backbone transceivers were actually swarms of antenna elements scattered across several light years, each element 10,000 kilometers across. Blueshell rolled forward and back, a quick gesture of agitation. We don't know, but it's nothing exceptional. Unless you're looking precisely at it with a large antenna, you'd never detect it from here. Greenstalk added,
We think that was part of their plan, though it is desperation on top of desperation. Since we came to relay, we've been talking to the org.
Discreetly, quietly, Blueshell put in abruptly.
Yes, we've asked the organization to listen for this ship. I'm afraid we haven't talked to the right people. No one seems to put much credence in us. After all, the story is ultimately from a lesser writer.
Yeah. What could they know that was under 100 years old?
What we're asking would normally be a great expense, and apparently prices are especially high right now.
Ravna tried to curb her enthusiasm. If she had read this in a news group, it would have been just one more interesting rumor. Why should she boggle just because she was getting it face to face? By the powers, what irony. Hundreds of customers from the top and the transcend, even old one, were saturating Relay's resources with their curiosity about the Stroumly debacle. What if the answer had been sitting in front of them, suppressed by the very eagerness of their investigation?
Just who have you been talking to? Never mind, never mind.
Maybe she should just go to Grander Collier with the story.
I think you should know that I am a...
Very minor.
Employee of the Vrinimi organization. I may be able to help.
She had expected some surprise at this sudden good luck,
Instead, there was a pause. Apparently, Blue Shell had lost his place in the conversation. Finally, Greenstalk spoke.
I am blushing. You see, we knew that. Blue Shell looked you up in the employees' directory. You were the only human in the org. You're not in customer contact, but we thought that if we chanced upon you, so to speak, you might give us a kindly hearing.
Blue Shell's tendrils rustled together sharply. Irritation? Or had he finally caught up to the conversation?
Yes. Well, since we are all being so frank, I suppose we should confess that this might even benefit us. If the refugee ship can prove that the perversion is not a full Class 2, then perhaps we can convince our buyers that our cargo has not been compromised. If they only knew, my certificate friends would be groveling at your feet, my Lady Ravna.
They stayed at the Wandering Company until well past midnight. Business picked up at the circadian peak of some of the new arrivals. Floor and table shows were raucous all around. Fom's eyes flickered this way and that, taking it all in. But above all, he seemed fascinated by Blue Shell and Greenstalk. The two were starkly non-human, in some ways even strange as aliens go. Scrota riders were one of the very few races that had achieved long-term stability in the beyond. Speciation had long ago occurred, varieties heading outward or becoming extinct. And still there were some who matched their ancient scrotas, a unique balance of outlook and machine interface that was more than a billion years old. But Blue Shell and Greenstalk were also traders, with much of the outlook that Fom Nguyen had known in the slowness. And though Fom acted as ignorant as ever, there was new diplomacy in him. Or maybe the awesomeness of the beyond was finally getting through his thick skull. He couldn't have asked for better drinking buddies. As a race, the Scrota riders preferred lazy reminiscence to almost any activity. Once delivered of their critical message, the two were quite content to talk of their life in the beyond, to explain things in whatever detail the barbarian could wish. The razor-jawed certificants stayed well lost. Ravna got a mild buzz on and watched the three talk shop. She smiled to herself. She was the outsider now, the person who had never done. Blue Shell and Greenstalk had been all over, and some of their story sounded wild even to her. Ravna had a theory, not that widely accepted, actually, that where beings have a common fluency, little else matters. Two of these three might be mistaken for potted trees on hot carts, and the third was unlike any human in her life. Their fluency was in an artificial language, and two of the voices were squawky raspings. Yet, after a few minutes listening, their personalities seemed to float in her mind's eye, more interesting than many of her school chums, but not that different. The two Scrota riders were mates. She hadn't thought that could count for much. Among riders, sex amounted to scarcely more than being next-door neighbors at the right time of year. Yet there was deep affection here. Greenstalk, especially, seemed a loving personality. He was shy yet stubborn, with a kind of honesty that might be a major handicap in a trader. Blue Shell made up for that failing. She could be glib and talkative, quite capable of maneuvering things his way. Underneath, Ravna glimpsed a compulsive person, uncomfortable with his own sneakiness, ultimately grateful when Greenstalk reined him in. And what a Fom Nguyen! Yes, what's the inner being you see there? In an odd way, he was more of a mystery. The arrogant boob of this afternoon seemed to be mostly invisible tonight. Maybe it had been a cover for insecurity. The fellow had been born in a male-dominated culture, virtually the opposite of the matriarchy that all beyonder humanity descended from. Underneath the arrogance, a very nice person might be living. Then there was the way he had faced down the razor jaw, and the way he was drawing out the Scrota riders. It occurred to Ravna that after a lifetime of reading romantic fiction, she had run into her first hero. It was after 02:30 when they left the Wandering Company.
The sun would be rising across the bow horizon in less than 5 hours. The two Skroda riders came outside to see them off. Blueshell had switched back to Somnorsh to regale Ravna with a story of his last visit to Chandra Kay, and to remind her to ask about the refugee ship. The Skroda riders dwindled beneath them as Ravna and Fom rose into the thinning air and headed toward the residential towers. The two humans didn't say anything for a couple of minutes. It was even possible that Fom Nguyen was impressed by the view. They were passing over gaps in the brightly lit docks, places where they could see through the parks and concourses to the surface of groundside 1,000 kilometers below. The clouds there were whirls of dark on dark. Ravna's residence was at the outer edge of the docks. Here the air fountains were of no use. Her apartment tower rose into frank vacuum. They glided down to her balcony, trading their suit's atmosphere for the apartments. Ravna's mouth was leading a life of its own, explaining how the residence was what she'd been assigned when she worked at the archive, that it was nothing compared to her new office. Fom Nguyen nodded, quiet-faced. There were none of the smart remarks of their earlier tours. She babbled on, and then they were inside, and she shut up, and they just looked at each other. In a way, she'd wanted this clown ever since Gronder's silly animation. But it wasn't till this evening at the Wandering Company that she'd felt right about bringing him home with her.
Well, I,
So, Ravna, the ravening princess, where is your glib tongue now? She settled for reaching out, putting her hand on his. Fom Nguyen smiled back, shy too, by the powers. I think you have a nice place, he said.
I've decorated it techno-primitive. Being stuck at the edge of the docks has its points. The natural view isn't messed up by city lights. Here, I'll show you.
She doused the lights and pulled the curtains aside. The window was a natural transparency looking out from the edge of the docks. The view tonight should be terrific. On the ride from the company, the sky had been awfully dark. The N-system factories must be offline or hidden behind groundside. Even ship traffic seemed sparse. She went back to stand by Fom. The window was a vague rectangle across her vision.
You have to wait a minute for your eyes to adjust. There's no amplification at all.
The curve of groundside was clear now, clouds with occasional pricks of light. She slipped her arm across his back and, after a moment, felt his across her shoulders. She'd guessed right. Tonight the galaxy owned the sky. It was a sight that dreamy old hands happily ignored. For Ravna, it was the most beautiful thing about Relay. Without enhancement, the light was faint. 20,000 light-years is a long, long way. At first, there was just a suggestion of mist and an occasional star. As her eyes adapted, the mist took shape, curving arcs, some places brighter, some dimmer. A minute more, and there were knots in the mist. There were streaks of utter black that separated the curving arms. Complexity on complexity, twisting toward the pale hub that was the core. Maelstrom, whirlpool, frozen still across half the sky. She heard Fom's breath catch in his throat. He said something, sing-song syllables that could not have been Trisk, and certainly not Somnorsh. All my life I lived in a tiny clump of that, and I thought I was a master of space. I never dreamed to stand and see the whole blessed thing at once. His hand tightened on her shoulder, then gentled, stroking her neck. And no matter how long we watch, will we see any sign of the zones?
She shook her head slowly. But they're easily imagined.
She gestured with her free hand. In the large, the zones of thought followed the mass distribution of the galaxy, the unthinking depths extending down to the soft glow of the galactic core. Farther out, the great slowness, where humankind had been born, where ultralight could not exist, and civilizations lived and died unknowing and unknown. And the beyond,
the stars about four-fifths up from the center, extending well off plane to include places like Relay. The known net had existed in some form for billions of years in the beyond. It was not a civilization. Few civilizations lasted longer than a million years. But the records of the past were quite complete. Sometimes they were intelligible. More often, reading them involved translations of translations of translations, passed down from one defunct race to another with no one to corroborate, worse than any multi-hop net message could ever be. Yet some things were quite clear. There had always been the zones of thought, though perhaps they were slightly inward moved now. There had always been wars and peace, and races upwelling from the great slowness, and thousands of little empires. There had always been races moving into the transcend to become the powers, or their prey.
"And the transcend," Fom said, "is that just the far dark?"
"The dark between the galaxies." Favna laughed softly. "It includes all that, but see the outer reaches of the spirals. They're in the transcend."
"Most everything farther than 40,000 light-years from the galactic center was."
Fom Nguyen was silent for a long moment. She felt a tiny shiver pass through him.
"After talking to the Wheelies, I think I understand more of what you were warning me about. There's a lot of things I don't know. Things that could kill me, or worse."
Common sense triumphs at last.
"True," she said quietly. "But it's not just you or the brief time you've been here. You could study your whole life and not know. How long must a fish study to understand human motivation? It's not a good analogy, but it's the only safe one. We are like dumb animals to the powers of the transcend. Think of all the different things people do to animals. Ingenious, sadistic, charitable, genocidal. Each has a million elaborations in the transcend. The zones are a natural protection. Without them, human equivalent intelligence would probably not exist."
She waved at the misty star swarms.
"The beyond and below are like a deep of ocean, and we the creatures that swim in the abyss. We're so far down that the beings on the surface, superior though they are, can't effectively reach us. Oh, they fish, and they sometimes blight the upper levels with poisons we don't even understand. But the abyss remains a relatively safe place." She paused. There was more to the analogy. "And just as with an ocean, there is a constant drift of flotsam from the top. There are things that can only be made at the top, that need close to sentient factories, but which can still work down here. Blueshell mentioned some of those when he was talking to you. The Agrav fabrics, the sapient devices. Such things are the greatest physical wealth of the beyond, since we can't make them. And getting them is a deadly risky endeavor." Fom turned toward her, away from Window and the stars.
"So there are always fish edging close to the surface."
For an instant she thought she had lost him, that he was caught by the romance of the transcendent death wish.
"Little fish risking everything for a piece of godhood, and not knowing heaven from hell even when they find it."
She felt him shiver, and then his arms were around her. She tilted her head up and found his lips waiting. It had been 2 years since Ravna Bergschendott left Chandra K. In some ways, the time had gone fast. Just now her body was telling her what a long, long time it really had been. Every touch was so vivid, waking desires carefully suppressed. Suddenly her skin was tingling all over. It took marvelous restraint to undress without tearing anything. Ravna was out of practice, and of course she had nothing recent to compare to, but Fom Nguyen was very, very good. Crypto Zero, as received by Transceiver Relay 01 at Relay. Language path.
Aquilaron to Trisqualine.
SJK. Relay units. From Net Administrator for Transceiver Wensong at Debley Down. Subject. Complaints about relay. A suggestion. Summary. It's getting worse. Try us instead. Key phrases. Communications problems. Relay unreliability. Transcend. Distribution. Communication costs. Special interest group. Motley Hatch Administration Group. Transceiver Relay 01 at Relay. Transceiver Not For Long at Shortstop. Follow-ups to Wensong Expansion Interest Group.
Date 07 hours 21 minutes 21 seconds. Docs time 36/09 of org year 52,089. Text of message. During the last 500 hours, Comcasts shows 9,834 transceiver layer congestion complaints against the Vrinimi operation at Relay.
Each of these complaints involves services to tens of thousands of planets. Vrinimi has promised again and again that the congestion is a purely temporary increase of transcendent usage. As Relay's chief competitor in this region, we of Wensong have benefited modestly from the overflow. However, until now, we thought it inappropriate to propose a coordinated response to the problem. The events of the last 7 hours compel us to change this policy.
Those reading this item already know about the incident. Most of you are the victims of it. Beginning at 00 hours, 00 minutes, 27 seconds, docs time, Vrinimi Org began taking transceivers offline, an unscheduled outage. R01 went out at 00 hours, 00 minutes, 27 seconds, R02 at 02 hours, 50 minutes, 32 seconds, R03 and R04 at 03 hours, 12 minutes, 01 seconds.
Vrinimi stated that a transcendent customer was urgently requesting bandwidth. R00 had been previously dedicated to that power's use. The customer required use of both up- and downlink bandwidth. By the org's own admission, the unscheduled usage exceeded 60% of their entire capacity. Note that the excesses of the preceding 500 hours, excesses which caused entirely justified complaint, were never more than 5% of org capacity. Friends, we of Wensong are in the long-haul communication business.
We know how difficult it is to maintain transceiver elements that mass as much a planet.
We know that hard contract commitments simply cannot be made by suppliers in our line of work. But at the same time, the behavior of Vrinimi Org is unacceptable. It's true that in the last 3 hours, the org has returned R01 through R04 through general service and promised to pass on the power's surpayment to all those who were inconvenienced. But only Vrinimi knows how large these surpayments really are. And no one, not even Vrinimi, knows whether this is the end of the outages. What is to Vrinimi a sudden incredible cash glut is to the rest of you an unaccountable disaster. Therefore, Wensong at Debley Down is considering a major and permanent expansion of our service, the construction of 5 additional backbone transceivers. Obviously, this will be immensely expensive. Transceivers are never cheap, and Debley Down does not have quite the geometry enjoyed by Relay. We expect the cost must be amortized over many decades of good business.
We can't undertake it without clear customer commitment. In order to determine this demand and to ensure that we build what is really needed, we are creating a temporary news group, Wensong Expansion Interest Group, moderated and archived at Wensong. Send, receive charges to transceiver layer customers on this group will be only 10% our usual. We urge you, our transceiver layer customers, to use this service to talk to each other, to decide what you can safely expect from Vrinimi Org in the future, and how you feel about our proposals. We are waiting to hear from you.
Chapter 9. Afterwards, Ravna slept well.
It was halfway through the morning when she drifted back toward wakefulness. The ring of her phone was monotonously insistent, loud enough to reach through the most pleasant dreams. She opened her eyes, disoriented and happy. She was lying with her arms wrapped tightly around a large pillow. Damn, he'd already left. She lay back for a second, remembering. These last 2 years she had been lonely. Till last night she hadn't realized how lonely. Happiness so unexpected, so intense. What a strange thing. The phone just kept ringing. Finally, she rolled out of bed and walked unsteadily across the room. There should be limits to this techno-primitive nonsense.
Yes?
It was a scroter rider. Greenstalk?
I'm sorry to bother you, Ravna, but are you all right?
The rider interrupted herself. Ravna suddenly realized that she might be looking a little strange. Sappy smile spread from ear to ear, hair sticking out in all directions. She rubbed her hand across her mouth, cutting back laughter.
Yes, I'm fine.
Fine.
What's up?
We want to thank you for your help. We had never dreamed that you were so highly placed. We'd been trying for hundreds of hours to persuade the org to listen for the refugees. But less than an hour after talking to you, we were told the survey is being undertaken immediately. Say what?
That's wonderful, but I'm not sure I... Who's paying for it anyway?
I don't know, but it is expensive. We were told they're dedicating a backbone transceiver to the search. If there's anyone transmitting, we should know in a matter of hours. They chatted for a few more minutes, Ravna gradually becoming more coherent as she parceled the various aspects of the last 10 hours into business and pleasure. She had half expected the org to bug her at the wandering company. Maybe Gronder just heard the story there and gave it full credit. But just yesterday he'd been wimping about transceiver saturation. Either way, this was good news, perhaps extraordinarily good. If the writer's wild story were true, the Stroumly perversion might be less than transcendent. And if the refugee ships had some clues on how to bring it down, Stroumly Rome might even be saved. After Greenstalk rang off, Ravna wandered about the apartment, getting herself in shape, playing the various possibilities against each other. Her actions became more purposeful, almost up to their usual speed. There were a lot of things she wanted to check into. Then the phone was ringing again. This time she previewed the caller. Whoops! It was Gronder Vrini Mikalir. She combed her hand back through her hair. It still looked like crap, and this phone was not up to deception. Suddenly she noticed that Gronder didn't look so hot either. His facial chitin was smudged, even across some of his freckles. She accepted the call.
Ah!
His voice actually squeaked, then returned to its normal level. Thank you for answering. I would have called earlier, except things have been very... chaotic. Just where had his cool distance gone? I just want you to know that the org had nothing to do with this. We were totally taken in until just a couple of hours ago. He launched into a disjointed description of massive demand swamping the org's resources. As he rambled, Ravna punched up a summary of recent relay business. By the powers that be, 60% diversion, excerpts from comm costs. She scanned quickly down the item from Windsong. The gas bags were as pompous as ever, but their offer to replace relay was probably for real. It was just the sort of thing Gronder had been afraid might happen.
Old One just kept asking for more and more. When we finally figured things out and confronted him, well, we came close to threatening violence. We have the resources to destroy his emissary vessel. No telling what his revenge might be, but we told Old One his demands were already destroying us. Thank the powers, he just seemed amused. He backed off. He's restricted to a single transceiver now, and that's on a signal search that has nothing to do with us.
One mystery solved. Old One must have been snooping around the wandering company and overheard the scroter rider's story.
Maybe things will be okay then, but it's important to be just as tough if Old One tries to abuse us again.
The words were already out of her mouth before she considered who she was giving advice to. Gronder didn't seem to notice. If anything, he was the one scrambling to agree.
Yes, yes. I'll tell you, if old one were any ordinary customer, we'd blacklist him forever for this deception. But then, if he were ordinary, he could never have fooled us.
Gronder wiped pudgy white fingers across his face.
No mere beyonder could have altered our record of the dredge expedition. Not even one from the top could have broken into the junkyard and manipulated the remains without our even suspecting.
Dredge? Remains? Ravna began to see that she and Gronder were not talking about the same thing.
Just what did Old One do?
The details? We're pretty sure of them now. Since the fall of Straum, Old One has been very interested in humans. Unfortunately, there were no willing ones available here.
It began manipulating us, rewriting our junkyard records. We've recovered a clean backup from a branch office. The dredge really did encounter the wreck of a human ship. There were human body parts in it, but nothing that we could have revived. Old One must have mixed and matched what he found there. Perhaps it fabricated memories by extrapolating from human cultural data in the archives. With hindsight, we can match its early requests with the invasion of our junkyard.
Gronder rattled on, but Ravna wasn't listening. Her eyes stared blindly through the phone's display.
We are little fish in the abyss, protected by the deep from the fishers above. But even if they can't live down here, the clever fisher folk still have their lures and deadly tricks.
And so Fom...
Fom Nguyen is just a robot, then, she said softly.
Not precisely. He is human, and with his fake memories, he can operate autonomously. But when Old One buys full bandwidth, the creature is fully an emissary device.
The hand and eye of a power.
Gronder's mouthparts clattered in abject embarrassment. Ravna, we don't know all that happened last night. There was no reason to have you under close surveillance, but Old One assures us that its need for direct investigation is over. In any case, we'll never give him the bandwidth to try again.
Ravna barely nodded. Her face suddenly felt cold. She had never felt such anger and such fright at the same time. She stood in a wave of dizziness and walked away from the phone, ignoring Gronder's worried cries. The stories from grad school came tumbling through her mind and the myths of a dozen human religions. Consequences, consequences. Some of them she could defend against. Others were past repair. And from somewhere in the back of her mind, an incredibly silly thought crawled out from under the horror and the rage. For 8 hours she had been face to face with a power. It was the sort of experience that made a chapter in textbooks, the sort of thing that was always far away and misreported. And it was the sort of thing no one in all of Chandra K could come near to claiming. Until now. Chapter 10. Johanna was in the boat for a long time. The sun never set, though now it was low behind her. Now it was high in front. Now all was cloudy and rain planked off the tarp covering her blankets. She spent the hours in an agonized haze. Things happened that could only have been dreams. There were creatures pulling at her clothes, blood sticking everywhere. Gentle hands and rat snouts dressed her wounds and forced chill water down her throat. When she thrashed around, Mom rearranged her blankets and comforted her with the strangest sounds. For hours, someone warm lay beside her. Sometimes it was Jeffrey. More often it was a large dog, a dog that purred. The rain passed. The sun was on the left side of the boat, but hidden behind a cold, snapping shadow. More and more the pain became divisible. Part of it was in her chest and shoulder, that stabbed through her whenever the boat wobbled. Part of it was in her gut, an emptiness that was not quite nausea. She was so hungry, so thirsty. More and more she was remembering, not dreaming. There were nightmares that would never go away. They had really happened. They were happening now.
The sun peeked in and out of the tumble of clouds. It slid slowly lower across the sky till it was almost behind the boat. She tried to remember what Daddy had been saying just before everything went bad. They were in this planet's Arctic in the summer, so the sun's low point must be north, and their twin-hulled boat was sailing roughly southwards. Wherever they were going, it was minute by minute farther from the spacecraft and any hope of finding Yefri. Sometimes the water was like open sea, the hills distant or hidden by low clouds. Sometimes they passed through narrows and swept close to walls of naked rock. She'd had no idea a sailboat could move so fast or be so dangerous. Four of the rack creatures worked desperately to keep them off the rocks. They bounded nimbly from mast platform to railing, sometimes standing each on the other's shoulders to extend their reach. The twin-hulled boat tilted and groaned in water that was suddenly rough. Then they'd be through, and the hills would be at a peaceful distance, sliding slowly past. For a long while, she pretended delirium. She moaned. She twisted. She watched. The boat hulls were long and narrow, almost like canoes. The sail was mounted between them. The shadow in her dreams had been that sail snapping in the cold, clean wind. The sky was an avalanche of grays, light and dark. There were birds up there. They dipped past the mast, circled again and again. There was twittering and hissing all around her, but the sound did not come from the birds. It was the monsters. She watched them through lowered lashes. These were the same kind that killed Mom and Dad. They even wore the same funny clothes, gray-green jackets studded with stirrups and pockets. Dogs or wolves, she had thought before. That didn't really describe them. Sure, they had four slender legs and pointy little ears, but with their long necks and occasionally reddish eyes, they might as well be huge rats. And the longer she watched them, the more horrible they seemed. A still image could never convey that horror. You had to see them in action. She watched four of them, the ones on her side of the boat, play with her data set. The pink Oliphant was tied in a net bag near the rear of the boat. Now the beasts wanted to look it over. At first it looked like a circus act, the creature's heads darting this way and that. But every move was so precise, so coordinated with all the others. They had no hands, but they could untie knots, each holding a piece of twine in its mouth and maneuvering its necks around others. At the same time, one's claws held the loose netting tight against the railing. It was like watching puppets run off a group control. In seconds, they had it out of the bag. Dogs would have let it slide to the bottom of the hull, then pushed it around with their noses. Not these things. Two put it onto a cross bench, while a third steadied it with its paw. They poked around the edges, concentrating on the plush flanges and floppy ears. They pushed and nuzzled, but with clear purpose. They were trying to open it. Two heads showed over the railing on the other hull. They made the gobbling, hissing sounds that were a cross between a bird call and someone throwing up. One of those on her side glanced back and made similar sounds. The other three continued to play with the data set's latches. Finally, they pulled the big floppy ear simultaneously. The data set popped open, and the top window went into Johanna's startup routine, and a nem of herself saying, "Shame on you, Yefri. Stay out of my things." The four creatures went rigid, their eyes suddenly wide. Johanna's four turned the set so the others could see. One held it down while another peered at the top window, and a third fumbled with the key window. The guys in the other hull went nuts, but none of them tried to get any closer. The random prodding of the four abruptly cut off her startup greeting. One of them glanced at the guys in the other hull. Another two watched Johanna. She continued to lie with her eyes almost closed.
"Shame on you, Yefri. Stay out of my things." Johanna's voice came again, but from one of the animals. It was a perfect playback. Then a girl's voice was moaning, crying. "Mom! Daddy!" It was her own voice again, but more frightened and childish than she ever wanted it to sound. They seemed to be waiting for the data set to respond. When nothing happened, one of them went back to pushing its nose against the windows. Everything valuable and all the dangerous programs were passworded. Insults and squawking emerged from the box, all the little surprises she had planted for her snooping little brother.
"Oh, Yeffrey, will I ever see you again?"
The sounds and vids kept the monsters amused for several minutes. Eventually, their random fiddlings convinced the dataset that somebody really young had opened up the box, and it shifted into kinder mode. The creatures knew she was watching. Of the four fooling with her Oliphant, one, not always the same one, was always watching her. They were playing games with her, pretending they didn't know she was pretending. Johanna opened her eyes wide and glared at the creature.
"Damn you!"
She looked in the other direction and screamed. The mob in the other hall were clumped together. Their heads rose on sinuous necks from the pile. In the low sunlight, their eyes glinted red, a pack of rats or snakes silently staring at her, and for heaven knew how long. The heads leaned forward at her cry, and she heard the scream again. Behind her, her own voice shouted, "Damn you!" Somewhere else, she was calling for "Mom" and "Daddy." Johanna screamed again, and they just echoed it back. She swallowed her terror and kept silent. The monsters kept it up for a half minute, the mimicking, the mixing of things she must have said in her sleep. When they saw they couldn't terrorize her that way anymore, the voices stopped being human. The gobbling went back and forth as if the two groups were negotiating or something. Finally, the four on her side closed her data set and tied it into the net bag. The six unwrapped themselves from each other. Three jumped to the outboard side of the hull. They gripped the edge tight in their claws and leaned into the wind. For once, they almost did look like dogs, big ones sitting at a car window sniffing at the airstream. The long necks swept forward and back. Every few seconds, one of them would dip its head out of sight into the water. Drinking? Fishing? Fishing. A head flipped up, tossing something small and green into the boat. The other three animals nosed about, grabbing it. She had a glimpse of tiny legs and a shiny carapace. One of the rats held it at the tip of its mouth while the other two pulled it apart. It was all done with their uncanny precision. The pack seemed like a single creature, and each neck a heavy tentacle that ended in a pair of jaws. Her gut twisted at the thought, but there was nothing to barf up. The fishing expedition went on another quarter hour. They got at least seven of the green things, but they weren't eating them, not all of them anyway. The dismembered leavings collected in a small wood bowl. More gobbling between the two sides. One of the six grabbed the bowl's edge in its mouth and crawled across the mast platform. The four on Johanna's side huddled together as if frightened of the visitor. Only after the bowl was set down and the intruder had returned to its side did the four in Johanna's hull poke their heads up again. One of the rats picked up the bowl. It and another walked toward her. Johanna swallowed. What torture was this? Her stomach twisted again. She was so hungry. She looked at the bowl again and realized that they were trying to feed her. The sun had just come out from under northern clouds. The low light was like some bright fall afternoon just after rain. Dark sky above, yet everything close by was bright and glistening. The creature's fur was deep and plush. One held the bowl towards her, while the other stuck its snout in and withdrew, something slick and green. It held the tidbit delicately, just with the tips of its long mouth. It turned and thrust the green thing toward her. Johanna shrank back.
"No!"
The creature paused. For a moment, she thought it was going to echo her. Then it dropped the lump back into the bowl. The first animal set it on the bench beside her. It looked up at her for an instant, then released the jaw-wide flange at the edge of the bowl. She had a glimpse of fine, pointy teeth. Johanna stared into the bowl, nausea fighting with hunger. Finally, she worked a hand out of her blanket and reached into it. Heads perked up around her, and there was an exchange of gobble comments between the two sides of the boat. Her fingers closed on something soft and cold. She lifted it into the sunlight. The body was gray-green, its sides glistening in the light.
The guys in the other hull had torn off the little legs and chopped away the head. What remained was only 2 or 3 centimeters long. It looked like filleted shellfish. Once she had liked such food, but that had been cooked. She almost dropped the thing when she felt it quiver in her hand. She brought it close to her mouth, touched it with her tongue. Salty. On Straum, most shellfish would make you very sick if you ate them raw. How could she know, all alone without parents or a local comnet? She felt tears coming. She said a bad word, stuffed the green thing into her mouth, and tried to chew. Blandness with the texture of suet and gristle. She gagged, spat it out, and tried to eat another. Altogether, she got parts of 2 down. Maybe that was for the best. She'd wait and see how much she barfed up. She lay back and saw several pairs of eyes watching. The gobbling with the other side of the boat picked up. Then one of them sidled toward her, carrying a leather bag with a spigot. A canteen. This creature was the biggest of all. The leader? It moved its head close to hers, putting the spout of the canteen near her mouth. The big one seemed sly, more cautious about approaching her than the others. Johanna's eyes traveled back along its flanks. Beyond the edge of its jacket, the pelt on its rear was mostly white, and scored deep with a Y-shaped scar. This is the one that killed Dad. Johanna's attack was not planned. Perhaps that's why it worked so well. She lunged past the canteen and swung her free arm around the thing's neck. She rolled over the animal, pinning it against the hull. By itself, it was smaller than she, and not strong enough to push her off. She felt its claws raking through the blankets, but somehow never quite cutting her. She put all her weight on the creature's spine, grabbed it where throat met jaw, and began slamming its head against the wood. Then the others were on her, muzzles poking under her, jaws grabbing at her sleeve. She felt rows of needle teeth just poking through the fabric. Their bodies buzzed with a sound from her dreams, a sound that went straight through her clothes and rattled her bones. They pulled her hand from the other's throat, twisting her. She felt the arrowhead tearing her inside. But there was still one thing she could do. Johanna pushed off with her feet, butting her head against the base of the other's jaw, smashing the top of its head into the hull. The bodies around her convulsed, and she was flipped onto her back. Pain was the only thing she could feel now. Neither rage nor fear could move her. Yet part of her was still aware of the 4. She had hurt them. She had hurt them all. 3 wandered drunkenly, making whistling sounds that for once seemed to come from their mouths. The one with the scarred butt lay on its side, twitching. She had punched a star-shaped wound in the top of its head. Blood dripped down past its eyes, red tears. Minutes passed, and the whistling stopped. The 4 creatures huddled together, and the familiar hissing resumed. The bleeding from her chest had started again. They stared at each other for a while. She smiled at her enemies. They could be hurt. She could hurt them. She felt better than she had since the landing. Chapter 11. Before the Flenser movement, woodcarvers had been the most famous city-state west of the Ice Fangs. Its founder went back 6 centuries. In those days, things had been harder in the north. Snow covered even the lowlands through most of the year. The woodcarver had started alone, a single pack in a little cabin on an inland bay. The pack was a hunter and a thinker as much as an artist. There had been no settlements for 100 miles around. Only 12 of the carver's early statues ever left his cabin, yet those statues had been his first fame. 3 were still in existence. There was a city by the Long Lakes named for the one in its museum. With fame had come apprentices. 1 cabin became 10, scattered across woodcarver's fjord. A century or 2 passed, and, of course, the woodcarver slowly changed. He feared the change, the feeling that a soul was slipping away. He tried to keep hold of himself. Almost everyone does, to one extent or another. In the worst case, the pack falls into perversion, perhaps becomes soul hollow. For woodcarver, the quest was itself the change. He studied how each member fits within the soul. He studied pups and their raising, and how you might guess the contributions of a new one.
he learned to shape the soul by training the members. Of course, little of this was new. It was the base of most religions, and every town had romance advisors and brood kenners. Such knowledge, whether valid or not, is important to any culture. What Woodcarver did was to look at it all again without traditional bias. He gently experimented on himself and on the other artists in his little colony. He watched the results, using them to design new experiments. He was guided by what he saw rather than by what he wanted to believe. By the various standards of his age, what he did was heresy or perversion or simple insanity. In the early years, King Woodcarver was hated almost as much as was Flenser 3 centuries later. But the far north was still going through its time of heavy winters. The nations of the south could not easily send armies as far as Woodcarver's. Once when they did, they were thoroughly defeated, and wisely, Woodcarver never attempted to subvert the South, not directly. But his settlement grew and grew, and its fame for art and furniture was small beside its other reputations. Old of heart traveled to the town, and came back not just younger, but smarter and happier. Ideas radiated from the town, weaving machines, gearboxes and windmills, factory postures. Something new had happened in this place. It wasn't the inventions, it was the people that Woodcarver had midwifed and the outlook he had created. Wick Rackscar and Jacques Ramathan arrived at Woodcarver's late in the afternoon. It had rained most of the day, but now the clouds had blown away and the sky was that bright, cloudless blue that was all the more beautiful after a stretch of cloudy days. Woodcarver's domain was paradise to Peregrine's eyes. He was tired of the packless wilderness. He was tired of worrying about the alien. Twenhulls paced them suspiciously for the last few miles. The boats were armed, and Peregrine and Scriber were coming from very much the wrong direction. But they were all alone, clearly harmless. Long callers hooted, relaying their story ahead. By the time they reached the harbor, they were heroes, 2 packs who had stolen unspecified treasure from the villains of the north. They sailed around a breakwater that hadn't existed on Peregrine's last trip and tied in at the moorage. The pier was crowded with soldiers and wagons. Townspeople were all over the road leading up to the city walls. This was as close to a mob scene as you could get and still have room for sober thought. Scriber bounced out of the boat and pranced about in obvious delight at the cheers from the hillside. "Quickly, we must speak with the woodcarver." Wick Rackscar picked up the canvas bag that held the alien's picture box and climbed carefully out of the boat. He was dizzy from the beating the alien had given him. Scar's 4 tympanum had been cut in the attack. For a moment he lost track of himself. The pier was very strange, stone at first glance, but walled with a spongy black material he hadn't seen since the South Seas. It should be brittle here. "Where am I? I should be happy about something, some victory." He paused to regroup. After a moment, both the pain and his thoughts sharpened. He would be like this for days yet, at least. Get help for the alien. Get it ashore. King Woodcarver's Lord Chamberlain was a mostly overweight dandy. Peregrine had not expected to see such at Woodcarver's, but the fellow became instantly cooperative when he saw the alien. He brought a doctor down to look at the 2 legs, and, incidentally, at Peregrine. The alien had gained strength in the last 2 days, but there had been no more violence. They got it ashore without much trouble. It stared at Peregrine out of its flat face, a look he knew was impotent rage. He touched Scar's head thoughtfully. The 2 legs was just waiting for the best opportunity to do more damage. Minutes later, the travelers were in Kerhog-drawn carriages, rolling up the cobblestone street toward the city walls. Soldiers cleared the way through the crowd. Scriber Jacques Ramathan waved this way and that, the handsome hero. By now Peregrine knew the shy insecurity that lurked within Scriber. This might be the high point of his whole life till now. Even if he wanted it, Wick Rackscar could not be so expansive. With one of Scar's tympana hurt, Wild gestures made him lose track of his thoughts. He hunkered down on the carriage seats and looked out in all directions. But for the shape of the outer harbor, the place was not at all what he remembered from 50 years ago. In most parts of the world, not much changed in 50 years. A pilgrim returning after such an interval might even be bored by the sameness. But this, it was almost scary. The huge breakwater was new. There were twice as many piers and multi-boats with flags he had never seen on this side of the world. The road had been here before, but narrow, with only a third as many turnoffs. Before, the town walls had been more to keep the carehogs and froghens in than any invaders out. Now the walls were 10 feet high, black stone extending as far as Peregrine could see. And there had been scarcely any soldiers last time. Now they were everywhere. That was not a good change. He felt a sinking in the pit of Scar's stomach. Soldiers and fighting were not good. They rode through the city gates and past a market maze that spread across acres. The alleys were only 50 feet wide, narrower, where bolts of cloth, furniture displays, and crates of fresh fruit encroached. Smells of fruit and spice and varnish hung in the air. The place was so crowded that the haggling was almost an orgy, and Dizzy Peregrine almost blacked out. Then they were on a narrow street that zigzagged through ranks of half-timbered buildings. Beyond the roofs loomed heavy fortifications. 10 minutes later, they were in the castle yard. They dismounted, and the Lord Chamberlain had the two legs moved to a litter.
"Woodcarver, he'll see us now," said Scriber.
The bureaucrat laughed.
"She! Woodcarver changed gender more than 10 years ago."
Peregrine's head twisted about in surprise. Precisely what would that mean? Most packs change with time, but he had never heard of Woodcarver being anything but he. He almost missed what the Lord Chamberlain said next.
"Even better, her whole council must see what you've brought. Come inside."
He waved the guards away. They walked down a hall almost wide enough for two packs to pass abreast. The Chamberlain led, followed by the travelers and the doctor with the alien's litter. The walls were high, padded with silver-crusted quilting. It was far grander than before, and again unsettling. There was scarcely any statuary, and what there was dated from centuries before. But there were pictures. He stumbled when he saw the first, and behind him he heard Scriber gasp. Peregrine had seen art all around the world. The mobs of the tropics preferred abstract murals, smudges of psychotic color. The South Seas islanders had never invented perspective. In their watercolors, distant objects simply floated in the upper half of the picture. In the Long Lakes Republic, representationism was currently favored, especially multiptychs that gave a whole pack view. But Peregrine had never seen the likes of these. The pictures were mosaics, each tile a ceramic square about a quarter inch on a side. There was no color, just four shades of gray. From a few feet away, the graininess was lost, and they were the most perfect landscapes Peregrine had ever seen. All were views from hilltops around Woodcarver's. Except for the lack of color, they might have been windows. The bottom of each picture was bounded by a rectangular frame, but the tops were irregular. The mosaics simply broke off at the horizon. The hall's quilted wall stood where the picture should have shown sky.
"Here now, fellow. I thought you wanted to see Woodcarver."
The remark was directed at Scriber. Jacques Ramafan was strung out along the landscapes, one of them sitting in front of a different picture all down the hall. He turned ahead to look at the Chamberlain. His voice sounded dazed.
"Soul's end. It's like being God, as if I have one member on each hilltop and can see everything at once."
But he scrambled to his feet and trotted to catch up. The hall opened on one of the largest indoor meeting rooms Peregrine had ever seen.
"This is as big as anything in the Republic," Scriber said with apparent admiration,
looking up at the three levels of balconies. They stood alone with the alien at the bottom. Besides the Chamberlain and the doctor, there were already five other packs in the room. More showed up as they watched. Most were dressed like nobles of the Republic, all jewels and furs,
A few wore the plain jackets he remembered from his last trip. Sigh. Woodcarver's little settlement had grown into a city and now a nation-state. Peregrine wondered if the king, the queen, had any real power now. He trained one head precisely on Scriber and high-talked at him.
Don't say anything about the picture box just yet.
Jacques Ramathan looked puzzled and conspiratorial all at once. He high-talked back.
Yes, yes. A bargaining card? Something like that.
Peregrine's eyes swept back and forth across the balconies. Most packs entered with an air of harried self-importance. He smiled to himself. One glance into the pit was enough to shatter their smugness. The air above him was filled with buzzing talk. None of the packs looked like Woodcarver, but then she'd have few of her members from before. He could only recognize her by manner and bearing. It shouldn't matter. He had carried some friendships far longer than any member's lifespan. But with others, the friend had changed in a decade, its viewpoints altering, affection turning to animosity. He'd been counting on Woodcarver being the same. Now, there was a brief sound of trumpets, almost like a call to order. The public doors of a lower balcony slid open, and a fivesome entered. Peregrine felt a twitchy thrill of horror. This was Woodcarver, but so misarranged. One member was so old it had to be helped by the rest. Two were scarcely more than puppies, and one of those a constant drooler. The largest member was white-eyed blind. It was the sort of thing you might see in a waterfront slum or in the last generation of incest. She looked down at Peregrine and smiled almost as if she recognized him. When she spoke, it was with the blind one. The voice was clear and firm.
"Please carry on, Vendacious."
The chamberlain nodded.
"As you wish, Your Majesty."
He pointed into the pit at the alien.
"That is the reason for this hasty meeting." "We can see monsters at the circus, Vendacious."
The voice came from an overdressed pack on the top balcony. To judge from the shouting that came from all sides, this was a minority view. One pack on a lower balcony jumped over the railing and tried to shoo the doctor away from the alien's litter. The chamberlain raised a head for silence and glared down at the fellow who had jumped into the pit.
"If you please, Scrupolo, be patient. Everyone will get a chance to look."
Scrupolo made some grumbling hisses, but backed off.
"Good."
Vendacious turned all his attention on Peregrine and Scriber.
"Your boat has outrun any news from the north, my friends. No one but I knows much of your story, and what I have is guard codes hooted across the bay. You say this creature flew down from the sky?"
It was an invitation to speechify. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.